But tonight, as we begin the book of Exodus, there's not a lot of additional material that has been supplied to help us see the sociological setting of the times, as there will be in other parts of this particular book. So the Chronological Study Bible gives you the text of the Bible, rearranged in chronological order to tell the story as it unfolded, and then with some additional information to help us see what's going on in the world, you know, around the Bible peoples during their time. This study is very rapid, so I hope everybody will appreciate, especially tonight, I was feeling it as I was preparing this class, that we're not doing a verse-by-verse study. We're not even doing a chapter-by-chapter study. This material is primarily designed so that everybody can finish reading the entire Bible in 18 months. Then, you know, that being our chief goal, at the same time, we're trying to add to that layers of understanding by reviewing the material that you've read, you know, in this evening's classes. Particularly tonight, trying to cover 12 chapters in the book of Exodus, some of the most fascinating material that there is in all of the Bible, the 10 plagues, you know, just for instance. It's just kind of heartbreaking, you know, that there are so many questions, so many things that we would like to discuss, that in good time, of course, we'll study the book of Exodus. We'll look at it chapter by chapter. There'll be plenty of time for all those questions. But tonight, we'll be going very, very rapidly, and since I really am hoping that along with reading the material, seeing how it fits into the historical context, we'll also be gaining some sense of a sort of an outline of our Bible so that we'll be able to get around in it and place things better in it, be more effective in our service to the God, to our God of heaven for that fact. And so each night you'll see me go through a lot of review material in which I'm intending to just kind of present it to you, you know, again, in a slightly different way, just trying to make the wheels click and see how much of this then hopefully we might be able to retain. So while we're going to be looking at Exodus here in just a little bit, we just finished Genesis. In the book of Genesis, we found that overall there are four main sections. Whether or not you can ever remember the actual chapter numbers, not that important, but just to recognize that at the same time, there are really four very prominent people who are discussed in the book of Genesis. Along with creation, and then that story about the separations of the languages in the first 11 chapters, Noah is our most prominent figure. 6, 7, 8, and 9 chapters are devoted to him. So he is the one person about whom the most is said in those 11 chapters. Followed by Abraham, and then Jacob, and then Joseph, although there's some additional information about Jacob that's sprinkled in there. Genesis is the story of creation and beginnings. And a terrible punishment, which all the earth was put to death for their sinfulness in the flood, save Noah, his three sons, and their wives. And then Abraham, to whom the great promise that will be the focus of all of the earth's history from that point on, starting in chapter 12, this promise to Abraham is given. Many different promises are given, but chief among them all is that in him, and in his seed, one would come, now, by which, through whom, all the world would be blessed. It is a descendant of Abraham that prophesied that will be the Messiah Savior, Jesus the Christ. Jacob is the grandson of Abraham, and his name will be changed to Israel, and he becomes the father of 12 sons, and therefore the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. Abraham was chosen to be the father of many nations, but most particularly to be the first, the father of the Jewish nation. Jacob would see in his descendants that nation divided into 12 tribal groups. And the relationship of those 12 tribes will be the subject matter for many, 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 many books to come. Genesis is the book of beginnings, and so the beginning of the Jewish people, here in Abraham, and especially in Jacob and his 12 sons, it is related for us. Then one of those sons is Joseph. Joseph had a hard life. Joseph's life was unfair. This man was mistreated many, many times. He suffered horribly. And the manner in which he met those trials is just magnificent. So he behaved most admirably. And always, though, his character was called into question. He served his God in faithfulness and would find enormous reward, the salvation of his entire family, the brothers of whom had all betrayed him, and therefore he would see God's plan eventually in all of his suffering and all of the injustice that he had suffered. Genesis is the story of creation and beginnings. And it is giving us the beginning of the story then of salvation and of redemption as well, which will be played out in the person of Jesus, the descendant of these central figures. Now, something else that we've been talking about, each time, tonight I wanted to put numbers on it for you, so it's just kind of a different way of looking at it again. But I want you to remember now, chapter 12, Abraham is down in Ur of the Chaldeans. This is the country we call Iraq today. He was told to leave his country, his family, and all that he had, and he was to travel to a land that God would show him. So, he would have taken roughly one of these two routes. That's the Fertile Crescent that you see right there. You can't survive the Arabian Desert. So he headed north to go west. And he would have gone, more likely, along a road that was known in those times. It was over here by the Tigris River, or else, more to the south and west, on the Euphrates. I don't know which route he took. He's a long time involved in this route. He's going to come up to a place called Haran, and then he's going to turn the corner of the Fertile Crescent, move on down, well, likely through Damascus, here to Sukkot, and across the Jordan River into Shechem, or Shechem, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. What I wanted you to see is that from the very beginning, Abraham was called to a 1,000-mile journey. And in these times, of course, this is tough stuff. It is dangerous every step of the way. There is life-threatening circumstances at all times. And so, numerous adventures that might be expected in a very difficult journey, driving herds very likely, walking most of the way, and suffering all the deprivation that one will on such an astonishing journey. Abraham, 1,000 miles just to get to that promised land, which I've outlined in the red down there now. You can see on this map that I speak of his coming into a land, and how much of it would he own? Where would he build his house? It's the promised land, but he's not going to own so much as a square foot. And he isn't going to build any kind of a permanent house. So, we see that as he comes across the Jordan River up here, this map shows that he went down into Egypt. We read about that. He came back up again here to Bethel. Hagar's going to flee from there. And as we're looking at all of this travel that's going on with Abraham still in the promised land and these others, you're looking at 450 miles of wandering in a land that's supposed to be his. But what was he in that land? A stranger, a sojourner, a wanderer throughout all of this time. Here's the patriarchal burial ground close by Hebron, the cave of Machpelah, where generation after generation of these Jews are going to be buried, and it would be the one piece of land that the family really owned as their own. Now we come to yet another map. How well were Jacob and Esau getting along? Okay, Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and from the beginning, there was all kinds of strife and trouble with them. This sibling rivalry would have resulted in a murder had not the mother intervened after she had created the problem to begin with. And so Jacob will flee the promised land. He's going to come back up here to Haran, through which Abraham had traveled before. He will find relatives that are still living up there, Laban's sheep among them. He'll find a wife up there for himself in a region called Padan Aram, and the city there is called Haran. And guess what? He's going to have to go about 500 miles to get there and 500 miles to find his way back again. What we're beginning to see is that these are a nomadic people. And even when they're in Padan Aram and in Haran, Does that mean they're living in a multiplex, you know, and going to the theater every night because they're, you know, really well established? Oh, yeah. No. What it means is they've got flocks and herds, and in order to sustain them, they are wandering constantly many, many miles to take care of those flocks. Just the journey itself one way is about 500 miles. He would come back. I love this picture here. This is of the Jabbok River, which flows from east to west and jumps into the Jordan River between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. It was somewhere in this immediate area where Jacob, driving his flock and with his children and his wives ahead of him, fearing the 400 soldiers of Esau, would meet and reconcile with his brother. So he's made that 500-mile journey again, somewhere right around here in these hills. They make peace and come back down into the promised land, which is known as Canaan at this time. Now, there's a number of different cities you can see on this particular map. Dothan up here is about two-thirds, I guess, the way between the top of the Dead Sea and lower portions of the Sea of Galilee there. This is where Joseph had gone north from Bethel in order, under orders from his father, see how his brothers were doing, because what are they doing with the flocks? Driving them hither and yon, and you have to go from one city to another. I don't have the scale right here, but I'm guessing it's something like 50 miles from the general region where they spend most of their time, you know, up here to Dothan. And then after this journey by himself of some 50 miles, let's say, what happens to Joseph? Sold into slavery because he did what? Told the truth about a prophecy, two of them, that he had received. So what happens to him? He gets captured now, taken all the way in this huge journey, comes down here, becomes a slave, has a number of adventures. We read about all of that, of course, last week. Here there was a priest in On, whose daughter he would marry. And that journey that you see in the red arrow right there is about 450 miles that he had to travel to come away from the region, you know, that he was calling home while they're wandering in it. What are these people? Are they settled? No. Are they permanently occupying anything? No, they are nomadic people. And it's a hard life. And so they are suffering because they are the chosen people. They are suffering terribly, as a matter of fact. Lots of problems. And one might begin to think, this just chosen stuff's not so great. You know? I mean, what am I getting out of it? What's in it for me? Well, each and every one, hopefully, learning the lesson as we must today. But God is not promising us this country. God did not call the United States, you know, the promised land. And while they had a physical land that was promised to them, it will be the land of the Jews and bear the name of Israel. Is that what God was chiefly concerned about when he made promises through Abraham? That people would have dirt while they lived in the flesh? No. That we would be blessed eternally because we have learned the lessons of faith and humility in the service of our God, regardless of how comfortable our lives are here while we're yet living them out in the flesh. Okay, so that brings us now to Exodus. We have followed in chronological order, because that's the way Genesis is produced, from the first creation of the universe down through the time that a misused and abused son finds himself number two over all of what? A superpower. Okay? Egypt is one of the great countries of the time. It's the United States of their era. Okay? And he's number two in command now. Saves the life of his family. We're going to see, as you did in the reading this week, that the book of Exodus, if possible, picks up the pace, you know, that we saw in Genesis. So, in the first chapter, we find out about this change of regimes. People rise up that don't know Joseph from the past. He's long dead.
his descendants and family are being persecuted now in that first chapter. In the second chapter, we're going to cover 80 years of Moses' life. The first 40 in which he is favored as a son or a grandson to Pharaoh. He is provided with all the best learning of the Egyptians. He has all the wealth and all the comfort and all the advantages that you can have as a very high-ranking authority. But he didn't get it the way Joseph did. Okay? He was adopted unknowingly and unwittingly, as you know the story so well. So the first 40 years went pretty well. And then what? He kills a guy trying to help out one of his Jewish brethren who is being abused. He has to flee for his life. And the next thing you know, what is Moses doing? Now, he went from a real settled existence. I mean, it was Palestine. Okay? And then what? Back to being another nomadic shepherd, you know, tending flocks, sheep and goats, off, you know, to the land of Midian. So we find out about that in chapter 2, and he's going to spend 40 years there. Chapters 3 and 4, everybody's familiar with the story of that burning bush that is not consumed, and God's calling Moses, I need for you to go back to Egypt, I got a job for you, and Moses is just happy as he can be, and God's calling him, right? Oh, woe is me, I don't want to do this, you know. And so one thing after another, he's arguing with the Lord, anybody but me. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, in chapter 5, the Jews are finding that their lives are getting even worse. And they're being persecuted, horribly so, beaten and abused as the chosen people and favored people of God. So in chapter 6, God's promise that he will rescue them. And Moses' genealogy is discussed. And then we begin to unfold this astonishing promise. You people, after all this suffering in this foreign land, are finally going to make another enormous journey and go back to that promised land, where finally you'll be able to settle and inhabit it. But first, we got to get you out of Egypt. So chapter 7 has the first of those 10 plagues. The water of the Nile is turned into blood. In chapter 8, we'll have 3 plagues. The frogs, the lice, and the flies. They all sound just really enjoyable. And then in chapter 9, we get a pestilence, boils, and hail. 3 more plagues, 5 through 7. In chapter 10, we have 3 more plagues, or 2 more plagues, 8 and 9, are the locusts and that unearthly, you know, surreal and terrifying darkness. And then in chapter 11, the announcement of the 10th and final plague. And in chapter 12, of course, the first Passover, that 10th plague is unleashed upon Egypt, and it is devastating, as still beyond words almost. And then, of course, the reason that the book has the title Exodus becomes apparent. What are the people now called to do? Leave. Now you know the story, you've read it before, and you've studied it before. Bad as it was in Egypt, was it a settled, stationary, certain, understood, you could predict what would happen the next day kind of a life? Yes! They were slaves, they knew where they were, and they were sitting in there. And so, when they left, now what are they going out into? Total uncertainty. Where am I going to spend the night tonight? Where is my food going to come from? How are we going to survive if Pharaoh's army coming after us? See, one thing adds all kinds of uncertainty. What are they being called to learn? Faith. Trust in your God. Believe that it is going to be all right. And it's amazing to us. They've watched 10 plagues be visited upon the Egyptians and not upon them. And they have watched 10 spectacular miracles take place, and they have been spared them all and told that by means of these things, you will be released, you will get to go back to your promised land. How long will it take? That's the next chapters. But you know how long it took them to forget this?
took 3 days.
In 3 days, they forgot it all.
Okay?
So, what are they being called to? Faith, humility, service, okay? Suffering, all right? But the confidence that God is with us, He's doing what should be done, and that it's right as it should be, and ultimately, are we seeking a physical country? No. If you were here Sunday night, it was the theme of the invitation on Sunday night. We read from Hebrews 11. If they'd been seeking a physical country, they would have had opportunity to what? To go back to Egypt. As a matter of fact, it won't be long after chapter 12, and they'll be pleading for that very thing, won't they? Some of them. It's just, it's terrible. But by means of miraculous punishment upon the Egyptians, these people set out to go where they've never been, to a land that has been promised, and freedom from slavery. Okay, they're going to have their problems, but that's what you saw the beginnings of this last week. Now, if you'll please come to page 71, if you happen to have a chronological Bible with you tonight. We're just going to open up to Exodus chapter 1. But, you know, the story here of the suffering in Egypt in chapter 1, I'm going to read starting at verse 8 through 11 in Exodus chapter 1. There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, they also join our enemies and fight against us. And so go up out of the land. We'll lose all our slaves." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. They built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. So they were busy about all of this when, you know the story, it was decided we're just going to have to stop the growth of this nation among us. There are too many of them already. So what were the midwives told to do? Kill any boy that is born to these Jews. We've got to put an end to this. So, out of fear, a minority that had all the abusive power is keeping, you know, put down a majority that apparently is physically stronger as well as numerically stronger. And so, Moses' mother apparently built something very like that. Now, if you did the reading of the ancillary material, you know, the extra information blocks and whatnot, you'll know that this Egyptian nation, because of the heat and the circumstances, you know, of the country, we have records preserved of them more so than we do virtually any other nation in antiquity. So they're fascinating people, enormous amounts of information. You know, and there are things like this about the basket weaving and all. This one being used as a coffin, and therein is the child. You know, it helps us to appreciate, though, look how intricate that is. See how it would be so easy to waterproof that. How tightly woven to begin with. How thick that weaving is. How it's reinforced with horizontal, you know, as well as vertical lacing. And then, if you use pitch, what does it become? It's an unsinkable boat. Okay? Now, if you were reading carefully as I was, though, in the story of Moses, it's hard for me to believe, even yet, that she would just put the kid in the water and just send him forth, you know, downstream kind of thing. And I'd rather doubt that was the case. I'm not even sure necessarily that she put him down in the water. She wanted it to be waterproof. Okay, but he was found among the reeds, and the reeds, you know, don't have to be, you know, in 3 feet of water. And so, maybe by the bank of the shore, whatever it was, but spied by Pharaoh's daughter, she has mercy on the child, as any woman would, I suppose, who's got any kind of a reasonable heart, you know, and so here's a child. What does she want to do to Moses? Adopt him, raise him up. So, she does. Now, we're going to skip down in chapter 2 of Exodus. Everybody come on down to verse 10, which would be in the right-hand column of 71, just about the middle there. And in chapter 2 and verse 10, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the what? the water. Now, sure enough, maybe floating then. She's gone down to bathe. I'm not denying that that's a possibility. I'm just saying she called in Moses because she had gone down to bathe. She was in that region, you know, marshy lands, and something like that was found. Now then, as the story develops, and you're not, I mean, it's just a couple of paragraphs later, in verses 11 and following, Moses, does he know that he's not a native-born Egyptian?
Yes.
Sure. Who is his nursemaid?
His mother.
His mother is raising him. He's getting all the training of the Egyptians, but he's also getting what? All the training of the Jews, too. He knows who he is. And so, well aware of it, as you look in chapter 2, in verse 11, came to pass in those days, Moses was grown, he went out to his brethren, and he looked at their burdens. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren, verse 11 ends. So in 12, he looked this way and that way. When he saw no one, what was he doing? This was not just, you know, lost his temper. This is a what? What do we call this in the legal system? Premeditated. He looked this way, he looked that way. When he didn't see anybody, he went and killed that Egyptian. And then what did he do with the body?
Buried
him in a shallow grave. Hit him in the sand. All right? Then he went out the second day. Behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. He said to the one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? And he said, who made you a prisoner and judge over us? You intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Uh-oh, what? See? Now, I don't know what happened. When he looked this way, and then he looked that way, and he didn't see anybody, maybe he should have also looked that way. Okay. So maybe he was observed by these others. Or maybe the Hebrew that he rescued had what? Loose lips, which?
Sink ship.
Okay. So maybe he got ratted out that way, you know, and I don't know. But the story came out. So when you turn the page or go to verse 14, I guess it is. Then Moses is afraid. He said, surely this thing is known. And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, well, you can't keep a secret, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh, dwelt in the land of Midian, sat down by a well. Okay? That, to me, is just one of the most morose statements in the Bible. He's like, was, you know, Pharaoh's grandson. So they were all, you know, they listened to great. And now, suddenly, because he's siding with his Hebrew brethren, where did he find himself? Sitting out by a well, you know, in Midian. Got nothing. You know, it's just the most forlorn kind of a picture. Here's a map for you. We're going to zoom in on this a little bit more in just a second. I want you to see, your course is the Nile, running northwards into a huge delta, which to this day, quite fertile, both along the course of the river as well as the delta. And these people have been living in Goshen, which we believe is over here on the eastern side, you know, of the delta there. And then that is separated from the promised land. Of course, you just go along the coast there, but there's this huge triangular piece of dirt we call what? Arabian Peninsula or Sinai Peninsula there. Okay, over here is the Gulf of Suez. Okay, here's the Gulf of Aqaba. Right, the Suez Canal starts right there, runs all the way clear to the Mediterranean Sea, Suez Canal. All right, so we're going to zoom in now a little bit on this. Now we've seen the general vicinity, and I'm going to add the word. Apparently, somewhere in this vicinity, or visiting with his brethren, you know, I'm not sure where Moses exactly was, but Moses finds himself traveling all the way around, apparently, because it's so dangerous to try to pass through, but somehow he gets across the entire Sinai Peninsula and finds himself over here in this region that's called Midian. Oddly enough, while working with the flock, he's going to find his way down on this side into the peninsula itself later to have his first conversations with God. So apparently the Midianites were either using this land or claimed this land as well. But this generally is the region that we're talking about. So how long is he going to spend there?
going to spend 40 years in Midian learning about what?
Sheep is right. Look at persistence. You know, more like faith, humility, service.
Okay, that's all synonymous with sheep, though, if you know anything about sheep. Okay, so he then, in chapter 3, meets what? Okay, so come to chapter 3, be on page 72, Exodus chapter 3. Oh, I guess I forgot to put my last deal up here.
That's 300 miles. I was trying to get to the sojournings of these people. So it's about a 300-mile journey to get out of Egypt, you know, over here to the other.
Okay, now we have the burning bush. He is called. We have miraculous signs that are presented to Moses himself. So he throws his rod down. What happens?
Turns into a snake, puts his hand in his shirt. What happens when he pulls it out? Leprosy, puts it back. Clean again.
So, okay, this is God that I'm talking to. He's asking me, you know, to leave my home. Okay, and go back where the Pharaoh wants to kill me. Okay, and rescue my people. And we all know how well that turned out. First time I tried my hand at that gate. Okay, so very reluctant, but he's heading home. Now, as you, does anybody just have any question about chapter 3?
I think the story of the burning bush, you know, it's so well embedded in our minds. We don't need to spend time on that. If you have a question, I'll entertain it.
But, okay, let's pass on that. I'm going to come to chapter 4. These are miraculous signs that are given to Moses so that he will be able to, hopefully, eventually, convince Pharaoh to let him go. Now, that we're in chapter 4, I want to spend some time with a question that I had facetiously told Moran I was trying to avoid, but he wouldn't let me do it. So whatever falls next, it's his fault entirely. But we have what has, you know, proven to be a kind of a really thorny problem regarding an expression, the hardening of a heart. Now, raise your hand if you have a heart. Okay. And if in the expression, raise your hand again, you know, you recognize that if it gets hardened, we're not talking about arteriosclerosis. Okay? In the Bible, when it's talking about hardening of a heart, what does that mean?
Hardening of the mind.
The mind is being hardened, which means, and you can see it very physically, our grandchildren are staying with us this week, as you know, and nice and hot, and had a lot of fun out there. Donna decided, you know, mud pies were the order of the day. So she took me out there, and she got her an actual pie tin and everything, you know, made some mud. And she's literally making mud pies. We now have a mud pie, by the way, that stands about that tall in a trash can, mounted on the top, got cucumbers on. All right. I'm telling a story, we'll get off of that. So the hardening of that mud, we understand. And when it is hardened, then I can't take my fingers and do what? See, if a heart is hardened like the mud is hardened, you can't penetrate it. You can't move it anymore. You can't form it or shape it. It becomes unresponsive, you know, and so the picture that we get from clay or other substances, you know, is now applied to a heart, and it has to do with whether or not the things that God wants to insert into that heart are being received, or else what? Like mud pies. It's bouncing right off again, like the cucumber. See, you can't insert them anymore. So we all get the picture. Now, the problem is, when we all understand the picture, is that God is said to harden Pharaoh's heart. In chapter 4 and verse 21. So everybody look at chapter 4, verse 21, be on page 74, right-hand column. The Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your hand. But who will harden his heart? I will. God will. So that he will not let the people go. So all Bible students, we look at this and we ask ourselves, what's the deal?
You know, how can you hold anybody accountable? If God is the one that hardens his heart, well, then the guy can't receive God's message and he's not going to let the people go.
But then, if you'll turn a couple pages to chapter 8, and this will be on page 78, if you have to have a chronological Bible, and in the right-hand column there, at the top of the right-hand column, chapter 8 and verse 15. When Pharaoh saw that there was relief from the second plague, what happened? He hardened his heart and did not heed them as the Lord had said. And then sure enough, God hardens Pharaoh's heart in chapter 7, verse 3, but Pharaoh hardens his heart in chapter 8, verse 32, and God hardens his heart in chapter 7, verse 13, but Pharaoh hardened his own heart in chapter 9, verse 34, and then God hardened it in chapter 9, verse 12, and in 1 Samuel 6, you get even outside this book, and it says, Pharaoh hardened his own heart when we're being told about it many long years later. So who hardened Pharaoh's heart? Well, there are seven more that say God did it, so it must have been God and Pharaoh didn't. Right? So.
In the beginning, when God spoke to Moses at Midian, didn't he say, I will harden his heart?
Yeah. God has said 11 times that he'll do it. Just with Pharaoh and with others. Did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Yes! Did Pharaoh harden his own heart?
Yes!
Okay? Now, is that some kind of conflict? So that now we can't believe the Bible anymore because the nitwits that wrote the book couldn't even figure out who did the hardening? A lot of people make it out that way. And believe me, they think this is really a big deal. You can find these atheistic websites. I did this week, preparing for this class. And they're using this proof that the Bible couldn't possibly have been written by God. Some foolish humans who couldn't even keep the story straight, came up with this stuff. So there's 11 times God did it in Exodus. There are four times, three in Exodus and one outside, where Pharaoh did it, and they call that a contradiction. See, that they can't both be true. There's conflict. Okay? Is that necessarily so?
No.
That is not necessarily so. So, who hardened whose heart? Was it Larry or the Seventh-day Adventist who won't study with me anymore after last week? I lost one this week. Okay? Now, whose fault is it? Who had all control and the other had none? See? What I want you to see, brethren, is that, yes, we had a hardening of the heart against me this week. And one of the three Adventist preachers I've been working with doesn't want to write any more letters, and he didn't come to the study yesterday, said he wants out. Now, I think that's in everybody's best interest, by the way. And the previous times he was not with us, and I studied with the other guys, we got a lot farther, it was more productive. This particular Adventist really was having a hard time with the study. He wasn't comfortable, he was very tense, he was very argumentative, combative, he was just really having a hard time. And now that he's gone, we've had another one of these much more productive sessions. But what happened? He's not receptive anymore. His heart to this discussion itself, let alone the very things I was trying to teach. So, I gave everybody a stupefied face earlier today. I would like for you to have a look at the page I handed out. At the top it says, which of these statements are true and which are false? About 6 weeks ago, I handed these out to three Adventist preachers. About 2 weeks ago, I handed it out to two more Adventist preacher wannabes. They're studying to become Adventist preachers. So I handed out five of these in the course of the last 6 weeks. In these five men, who all count themselves as teachers and leaders among Adventists, how many have circled a single T or an F? Not one. So, I asked them to do it again, and some of them I've asked to do it again and again, and as the weeks have gone by, 5 men have been repeatedly called back to this, which I have both emailed them and given them the same hard copy that you hold in their hand. And all I've asked them to do is circle a T or an F for each statement. Does it reflect what you believe, which is true and which is false? And I cannot get any Adventist to circle true or false on any one of these statements. Now, let me tell you what these are about. Every one of those 10 statements reflects with extreme accuracy what the Seventh-day Adventist Church teaches. And I know this because some of these things I got directly from these men's own mouths recently, or I have read them in the 28 Fundamental Beliefs, an official publication of the Adventist Church, and in the Seventh-day Adventist Church Manual. I know, and so do they, that if you are a Seventh-day Adventist, you must necessarily circle true for all 10 of those statements because they precisely, accurately, and absolutely reflect the precise belief, the faith, of the Seventh-day Adventist Church when it comes to verses that deal with baptism. But now you, who are much more familiar with the Bible's verses on baptism, when you look at this page, what would you be circling, T or F? F. How many times?
Every time.
Every time. Because all 10 of these statements are absolutely false. Now then, why won't the Adventist circle the T? Because when he reads the sentence, he knows unquestionably that is what he believes. But because I phrase it this way, what does he also see? You've got to rewrite a Bible verse to get Adventist doctrine because the Bible verse does not say what the Adventist believes. They immediately recognize every one of these is a rewritten passage of Scripture which does not say that. What that says on the page is what the Adventist believes. And they recognize that this is also taking a Bible verse and negating it, rewriting it, rearranging it, in some way altering it so that it now says the opposite of what it actually says in the Scripture. And so, how can they answer? There you are. You can't win. Because they know this is what I believe, and if I circle true, then I have just denied what the verse actually says, and they know Larry's going to take it over there, and he's going to show me, you know, and rewrite the verse. So, what is it? I call it the 10 imponderables. That's what I've been calling it for the Adventists. They're right there. I told the guys, these are the 10 imponderables. These are the 10 things that Adventists cannot figure out. You know? And I told the last one, one of the others that's not a local preacher also refuses to study with me anymore. He started golf hard this week. Okay? That's pretty telling, isn't it? Now, who hardened the Adventist's heart so they won't study with me anymore? 2 out of 5 quit this week. Who hardened their heart? Well, I did, because I wrote these 10 statements. I did it. It's my fault. If I had just not done this, they'd all be Christians today, right? Hardly. Because who hardened their hearts? They did. Okay? But at this moment, when conflict came between Larry and 2 of the 5 Adventists this week, so 2 of them wrote me off and I said, no way, I don't want to do you anymore. Okay? Fine. His heart is now hardened toward me. Did I do it? Yes. Things that I wrote, including this and many others, provoked that response. I pushed buttons. I presented problems. I challenged. I tested. See, I put them, you know, face to face with their own inconsistencies. So I did it. But who did it? They did it. Now, Pharaoh and God. What did God do? Pharaoh let my people go. Why? I just turned a rod into a snake and my hand into leprosy and then healed it again. Well, that's not enough. Okay? So we start down the road of the plagues. With each plague, who had the power of the plague? God did. Okay? Now, Pharaoh looks at this, and what can he do? He's helpless. But did he say, okay, God, okay, I'm going to let the people go? No. In fact, time again, he said he would, and then what? He changed his mind as soon as, you know, the relief came off. So, this is what happened, brethren. 11 times the scripture says God did it. Because with 10 plagues, who was the actor? And what was God showing the Egyptians every time? Was it Ra? No. Was it any other god of the Egyptians? No. Who is God? And for the first time introduced now, I don't know if you read carefully, you would have seen the word Lord in all capital letters. In a little footnote, you look at the bottom, and you said, God said, I haven't used this name before, but I'm using it now. Now, I am. And I am Jehovah Yahweh, translated Lord. So every time you read your Bible from that point on, capital L-O-R-D, or capitals, what do you know you're looking at? Jehovah, Yahweh, which God introduced. Now, the word translated Lord, see, Jehovah, is now going to be used going forward as the God of who? The Hebrews, the Jews, Israel. Okay? More or less powerful than any old one of the sometimes numerous Egyptian gods. Far more powerful. You've probably seen various things. It's apparent that the Egyptians, again with all the archaeological evidence, had a god over every one of these things that Moses sent a plague to defeat, thus demonstrating that that supposed god had how much power against Jehovah? None. There were 9 gods that were being, you know, defeated there in the course when the, you know, firstborn son died. So, this whole hardening thing, brethren, it's not a biblical contradiction. It's nothing, you know, of the kind. If people just take a few minutes and think about it, happens every day. And the best illustration I've ever heard of it is going on right now, thanks to Mud Pies again. The same sun which melts butter does what to clay? Hardens it. We've all heard the illustration before. The light of God's truth will reveal what the heart is. The heart is either good and healthy, receptive and soft, and it will take into it the teachings of God and mold itself after those teachings. Or those teachings will come, and what will happen in the light of those teachings? The heart will harden itself into concrete. See, impenetrable to the Word of God. Who did it? God did it. Through His Word. Who did it? Your choice. Whether you have a receptive heart or not. Okay, see how that works? Okay, any comment or question on that? Okay, that's my chart for tonight. So let's come on back to the book itself. These encounters begin to unfold. And so, one chapter after another, until let's just pass over all of these and come down to the death of the firstborn. So everybody to chapter 11 then. In chapter 11, be the top right of page 81. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 1, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here altogether. Speak now in the hearing of the people, and let every man ask from his neighbor and every woman from her neighbor articles of silver and articles of gold. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. How did the Lord give the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians? Just like the hardening, didn't he? They had been through the 9 plagues. What had they learned?
You better not fight these Hebrews, because their God's pretty powerful. Now, if they want gold, what are we going to do? Please. All you want. Okay? So their hearts were softened toward these Jews and toward God. Okay? So, immediately, the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. Pharaoh didn't think much of him, but people sure did. Verse 4, Moses said, thus says the Lord. How's that Lord spelled? All capitals. What's the Hebrew word behind it? Yahweh or Jehovah. Okay, about midnight I'll go out in the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn of the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who's behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals. Then there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again. But against none of the children of Israel shall a dog move its tongue, against man or beast, that you may know that the Lord does make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. And all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, get out, and all the people who follow you. After that I will go out. Then he went out from Pharaoh in great anger. But the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not heed you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. So Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh. And the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the children of Israel go out of his land. Now, we're going to chapter 12. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it, according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. They shall take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire with unleavened bread, with bitter herbs. They shall eat it. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails. You shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. Thus you shall eat it with belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am Yahweh. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. What happened that night? This is the first, capital P, Passover. Because the angel of death passed over the Jews' houses with the blood of the sacrificial lamb on the doorpost and the lintel. Okay? And in that night, what happened in every Egyptian household and barn? Firstborn dies. And then we are told in the story, and you can only imagine the horror of it, the great cry
that went up in the darkness of that night. Nothing like it before, nothing like it after, because there's never been like it anything before or after. Can you imagine if tonight in Eugene, every firstborn dies, dog and cat, sheep and goat, people. If so, I won't be here tomorrow. I'm a firstborn. Okay? How many are there in Eugene? And how long would it take for neighbor to neighbor to neighbor to be hearing what in the night? Oh, it was bad. It was bad. And then, what began?
Exodus.
Okay? Let's close in prayer.